For the World's podcast and the following message come from LegalZoom. Running a small business is a lot of work. It takes time and money, and you want all the time and money you have to go towards growing your business. But what happens when legal hurdles pop up along the way? LegalZoom is there to help. Get advice for running your business from vetted independent attorneys and tax professionals available in all 50 states. The best part is you won't get charged by the hour since LegalZoom isn't a law firm. Check out LegalZoom's business legal plan at LegalZoom.com now and get special savings when you enter the word world at checkout. LegalZoom, where life meets legal. LegalZoom.com.
Who gets stuck with the tariff bill today on The World? I'm Marco Werman. In the tariff war between the U.S. and China, President Trump claims China is the one paying the bill. Many economists disagree.
What we found is that the tariffs are passed on completely to U.S. consumers.
Also, lawmakers in Australia passed a law that requires social media companies to remove violent content expeditiously. Sounds good, but what's that mean?
The real problem here is that it's actually quite vague about what platforms are required to do.
Plus, a Japanese spacecraft blasts a hole into an asteroid, you know, for science.
The Japanese really have made history today. It's what exploration is all about.
Those stories and more today on The World. Good economic news today. Nearly 200,000 jobs were added last month, so that makes 102 straight months of job gains. In other positive economic news, the trade war with China may be coming to an end. President Trump says an epic trade deal is almost ready. Skeptics are not so sure. The U.S. and China have been in a battle over tariffs for a year now, and new research shows that the tariffs are taking a toll, but not the toll that was intended. Here's The World's Jason Margolis.
Consider a bottle of French wine. Say the U.S. were to impose a 25% tariff, an import tax on a $100 bottle. The American importer would have to pay an extra $25 at the border to get that bottle, check made out to the U.S. government. The idea behind that tariff would be to make that French wine more expensive for Americans and hopefully push them to start buying more Napa wine. A year ago, President Trump was threatening to slap tariffs on thousands of Chinese imports. At the time, I talked with people like David Bergman, CEO of the Butler Specialty Company in Chicago. They import furniture from China. Bergman said if tariffs were put on the Chinese-made furniture he imports,
I think that I will be able to pass through the tariff to my customer. I think the consumer ultimately, though, is the one that's going to have to pay more for the product. And the same is true of every manufacturer of all goods. It's not just furniture.
President Trump disagreed. The administration put tariffs on furniture and some 9,000 other goods from China. A few weeks ago, Trump said China is getting stuck with the tariff bill.
The money we have pouring in now, we've never had money like that pouring in from China. We are collecting billions and billions of dollars, mostly paid for by China. If you look at the 25%, a report was done where 4 points out of the 25% are paid for by us and 21 points are paid for by China.
Let me just unpack that. Trump is saying that Chinese manufacturers are covering most of the costs of the tariffs by lowering their prices. So, what's the reality? Did China surrender, or are American shoppers getting stuck with the bill? Trade economist David Weinstein at Columbia University looked into this.
So we looked at air conditioners, we looked at wooden dining room tables, we looked at space heaters. And so what we found is that the tariffs are passed on completely to U.S. consumers.
Trump was wrong. The Chicago furniture importer was right. But it's case by case. I reached out again to David Bergman in Chicago via email. He says he can't pass along all the costs to his furniture buyers because there's just too much pressure to keep prices low. So Bergman is making less money. Another group of economists digged into this same question. How much more are American consumers paying because of the tariffs? Patrick Kennedy at the University of California, Berkeley, says it's an extra $69 billion a year.
And in per capita terms, that's roughly $213 per person per year.
And that's just an average.
It's certainly possible that some consumers are going to be paying a lot more than that, depending on if they're buying a car or a washing machine that year.
Last year, the Trump administration imposed tariffs on imported washing machines and steel. And here's another cost to consumers, says David Weinstein, less choice.
One of the other big gains from trade is that we get to consume many varieties of products that we wouldn't ordinarily be able to consume. When I was a kid, coffee came in two types. There was Nescafe and Sanka.
He's talking decaf. Still, today we can stand in the coffee aisle for minutes paralyzed with choice. That said, Weinstein says consumers often won't notice most products disappearing from shelves.
But, you know, if you're in the market for a space heater or you're in the market for an air conditioner or a washing machine and you can't get the brand anymore because the company faced the tariffs and is now out of business or is no longer selling in the United States market, that entails a real cost to you.
We're already importing fewer products targeted by tariffs in the past year. Those imports are down by about a third. But at the end of the day, the president says the trade war is about bringing jobs back to the United States and addressing some very real problems with China. Economists tend to not like tariffs because they're inefficient. Thus far, very few American jobs have been created in industries targeted by tariffs, and they've come at a substantial cost to the rest of us. And trade experts like Weinstein don't see Trump getting the epic concessions from China that he's promising. Last year, Trump tweeted that he's a tariff man and, quote, trade wars are good and easy to win. They're not.
China, as a sovereign state, is not very open to the idea of buckling under U.S. pressure. And so they have their hackles up. We have our hackles up. And politically, these things get very, very entrenched.
In the meantime, expect to pay a little to a lot more the next time you go shopping. For The World, I'm Jason Margolis.
The tiny Asian country of Brunei doesn't usually get a lot of notice. You may know its king, its sultan, technically, is one of the richest men in the world. But his kingdom is also now the focus of international outrage because Brunei says it's going to apply the death penalty for the crime of gay sex. The anger is quickly turned into a boycott of the sultan's luxury hotel chain, an effort led by George Clooney, Ellen DeGeneres, other celebs. Los Angeles officials have also joined in, including Karina Samala. She's the chair of the Transgender Advisory Council for the city.
As a Filipino-American transgender woman and a member of the LGBTQ community, I was really horrified by the decision of the Sultan of Brunei, stoning to death of adults engaging in consensual same-sex relations. I'm so afraid for my community members because I have friends also that lives in Indonesia and Malaysia, transgender friends, that are very concerned with what's going on there. And it concerns them because they can also be arrested and fined and put in jail, I was told. Because although those nations are kind of moderate, Islamic nations like Indonesia and Malaysia, it still concerns them a lot. Mm.
Well, the Kingdom of Brunei owns the Beverly Hills Hotel and the Bel Air, both in L.A., and seven others around the world within the Dorchester Group. How is this actually an effective way to protest the boycott? I mean, even George Clooney admits that Brunei being a monarchy, this pressure probably won't amount to much.
Yeah, especially they are a very rich oil country. And the boycott is just kind of for us to really boycott the Sultan's business interests, so that they are aware that we are not pleased with what's going on back there.
Homosexuality, as you know, has been illegal for 10 years in Brunei. Sharia law officially came into effect in 2014. And at the time then, all sorts of celebrities boycotted the Beverly Hills Hotel. That was 5 years ago. So what's been going on with the activism against Brunei since then?
Yeah, but it has, it started 2013, 2014, but it was implemented and came to effect this year. At that time, we raised our concern and also said, but now this is the final straw to it, is this finalization and being a law now, starting this two days ago, put into effect. And that's what you know, again, it's just ignited our community and the raise a concern, greatly concerned for our own people and our own safety.
Karina, in Los Angeles, you're known as a mother to the LGBTQ community in L.A. How did you earn that title?
I've worked with my community for over 25 years dealing with the transgender community, more focused on the transgender community because we are marginalized. We've always been, you know, the highest rate of murders in the country and all over the world is against the transgender community because of ignorance and also discrimination and hate. Even our own family members do not understand, and a lot of our transgender youth are thrown out on the streets early on in life because of parents' non-acceptance of them. So they end up on the streets to live their own authentic lives being themselves. I'm very lucky that my family accepts where I am. A lot of my community members come up to me for help. It doesn't matter how old they are. They still call me mother, and they even come to me and, can I also be your daughter? Can I also call you mother? You know, because I've always been there to help them and guide them.
Karina Somalo is the chair of the Transgender Advisory Council in Los Angeles. She and others have been calling for boycotts against hotels owned by the Sultan of Brunei in protest of the country's anti-LGBTQ laws. Karina, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Imagine this. Mark Zuckerberg gets extradited to Australia over a violent video that a user posts to Facebook. Seems far-fetched, right? But it's exactly what Australian lawmakers want the ability to do under a new law they passed this week. Here's The World's Lydia Emanuelidou.
The point of this new law is to get social media companies to move quickly to take down violent content that's posted on their platforms. Australia's parliament took up the legislation after last month's terror attack in neighboring New Zealand.
Welcome back to our continuing coverage of the attacks in Christchurch, New Zealand.
The suspected gunman in the New Zealand mosque shootings live streamed a video of the attack for 17 minutes.
Live streamed on Facebook, replayed on YouTube, many other websites. It was available hours after the attack.
The legislation says that social media executives could face jail time and fines in the billions if videos showing terrorist attacks, murders, rape, or kidnapping are not removed from their platforms, quote, expeditiously. But what does that mean exactly? No one really knows. Even Australia's Attorney General, Christian Porter, couldn't explain. He spoke at a news conference on Thursday after the bill passed both houses of parliament.
Using the Christchurch example, I can't precisely say what would have been the point of time at which it would have been reasonable for them to understand that this was live streaming on their site or playable on their site and they should have removed it. But what I can say, and I think every Australian would agree, it was totally unreasonable that it should exist on their site for well over an hour without them taking any action whatsoever.
Australia is not the first country to hold social media companies accountable for what's posted on their sites. In Germany, for example, they have a law that says platforms have to remove things like hate speech and fake news within 24 hours or face fines. Nicola Susor is a law professor at Queensland University of Technology. He says governments around the world are scrambling to figure out the right way to regulate the internet.
What that means is that too often we get knee-jerk reactions and sloppily designed laws that don't really understand how you could regulate tech companies in a way that preserves innovation and freedom of speech and access to information. That's the big problem that we have, not that countries want to regulate, but that they're going about it the wrong way.
Under Australia's new legislation, Professor Susor says, there's a danger that companies will go overboard and take down legal content.
Think of the example of the shooting of Philando Castile.
Philando Castile was shot and killed by a police officer during a traffic stop in Minnesota in 2016. His girlfriend live-streamed the aftermath of the shooting on Facebook.
Oh my God, please don't tell me he's dead. Please don't tell me my boyfriend just went like that.
This is something that is documented on social media. And it's not something that would be technically prohibited under this law, but there's no way that an algorithm can easily figure it out. So my real concern here is that any technical response from the platforms will either be ineffective or much too broad in the type of content that it restricts.
This kind of legislation is also creating uncertainty for Australia's tech industry, says Sarah Moran. She runs a tech company called Girl Geek Academy that's all about getting girls and women into tech.
So it makes my job really hard, particularly when you're talking to aspirational young people, to say, I love that you want to build technology, but I cannot tell you what is on the horizon from the politicians that may choose to prevent you from doing that.
For the World, I'm Lydia Manolidou.
What is the right way to deal with the bullying of Muslim students in American schools? It is a key question at the heart of a drawn-out legal struggle in San Diego, a struggle that has finally ended. The World's Rupa Shenoy has been following the case and is here with me now to talk about it. Hey, Rupa.
Hi, Marco.
So lay this all out for us. What happened?
It started in 2016 when Muslim parents and students came to the San Diego School Board about bullying. The Council on American Islamic Relations, CARE, offered to partner with the district on an anti-bullying curriculum. And CARE hoped that this relationship with the San Diego district would be a model for other partnerships with other schools across the country.
But some San Diego district parents objected, right?
There's a small group of parents who sued, including a small group of Asian parents led by Frank Hsu. I talked to him, and he said he doesn't believe there was an increase in Islamophobic bullying. He claims it was just a way for CARE to get into schools.
It's wrong for them to partner with CARE, which is obviously a religious organization, because they work together to indoctrinate the students.
That's a really strong pushback.
People tell him that statement itself is Islamophobic. And that frustrates him because he says he's an immigrant from China who experienced not having freedom of religion and speech. And that's why it's so important for him to uphold it here.
So some pushback from parents. What happened next in the case?
The district backed out of the partnership with CARE in 2017 to the frustration of many parents, Muslim and non-Muslim.
And the lawsuit continued, though, right?
Yeah, the parents' group kept suing because they said the district was still exchanging emails with CARE. And Hsu says that amounted to them privileging one religious group over others.
But now there's been a resolution after 3 years of litigation.
Right. They agreed on a settlement.
And what does that say?
A lot. So I'll summarize. Guest speakers from religious organizations are not permitted to present to students on religious topics, and religions must be taught in the context of world history, with the time on each religion determined by its impact. And how that's measured, who does the measuring, that isn't specified.
And that parent who sued, what does he think of the settlement?
Frank Hsu. He says this is a victory.
What does the San Diego School District say about that?
The district's attorney, Andrew Green, says the district was doing everything in the settlement already, so nothing's really changing. I asked Green if teachers can still talk specifically about Islamophobic bullying, and she said yes, but they also talk about all kinds of bullying.
And what does CARE have to say about all this?
So I talked to their lead attorney, Ghadir Abbas. And like the school district, he doesn't think the settlement does anything that wasn't happening before. But Abbas says the suit itself is an indication of an overall Islamophobic sentiment that's also responsible for things like the recent mosque attack in San Diego, an arson attack that referenced the New Zealand shootings.
It is not a coincidence. These are all related to each other.
Rupa, is the Council on American Islamic Relations working with other school districts?
Yeah, they are.
This is the first of what's going to be many attempts to exclude the Muslim community from public schools across the country. This is a sign of things to come.
I asked Abbas about Hsu and others calling CARE a religious organization. And Abbas says CARE is a civil rights organization, not a theological one, but it is, quote, grounded in faith.
The World's Rupa Shenoy, thanks very much for getting us up to speed on this.
Thank you.
He was a rapper first, but for many people around the world, he was Eritrean first and foremost.
My real name, it means God will rise. It's Ermias, though. That's how you say it.
That's right. Ermias Ashkadam, a.k.a. Nipsey Hussle. It's been almost a week since Nipsey Hussle was shot and killed in South L.A., the neighborhood that he celebrated in his music. His mother is from L.A. His dad is from Eritrea. Since Hussle died, vigils have been popping up all over the world, especially in cities with large East African communities. Felman Hagos is Eritrean and Dutch, and yesterday organized a vigil in Rotterdam, where he lives. So, Felman, this vigil was for really all of the Netherlands. Let me back up to your reaction to the death of Nipsey Hussle. What did you think when you heard the news?
I heard this around 4 o'clock in the night, so for me it was like, is this real or am I still dreaming or is this a nightmare? It took me like 2 hours to really see this is reality. And it was a big shock, you know, because Nipsey also is like our big motivator for all Eritreans around the world.
What was the vigil like that you organized last night in Rotterdam? Who showed up?
It was a vigil where we were talking about Nipsey. We were trying to get closer to each other. The whole mindset of Nipsey, his whole state of mind was like, we need to get closer to each other as a community. So we were like trying to support his whole state of mind about how we should come together and be stronger together.
Felmon, when did you first discover Nipsey Hussle's music and what did he mean to you?
I discovered it because of there's one friend of us. He is like always listening to American music. And this guy was always like, hey, there's an Eritrean rapper. And I always liked his message, you know.
What Nipsey Hussle songs really kind of stand out for you?
Yeah, okay, now you're asking me something. big question. There's one track with Grinding where he's talking about hustling and doing everything by himself.
All my life, been grinding all my life. Sacrifice, hustle paid the price. Want a slice, got to roll the dice. That's why all my life I've been grinding all
That's my favorite one, but what gets me is his message.
Sacrifice, hustle paid the price. Want a slice, got to roll the dice.
And how would you describe that message? What is his big headline?
Bro, his message is about just motivating people, the youth, the children, come together. All things we all have issues with in the black community. I think that's the reason why a lot of people are grieving at this moment, because this guy has something that we did not see for a long time with our black artists, you know. And for me, he was like the Tupac of 2019, you know?
Yeah. No, it's something a lot of people have said, that it's not just rap. It's a kind of a social connection and advocacy for people.
Definitely. And believe me, if his social input, that's the difference why it's so huge. If you see his interviews, he was just like 20 years old. And at this young age, he was already guiding us with his mission. That's pretty amazing for a guy of 20 years old, you know. He passed away 33. Can you imagine of his greatness if he was becoming 40?
Sadly, we can only imagine right now. Nipsey Hussle from Los Angeles, but he visited Eritrea a couple of times. And during an interview last year, he spoke about what that meant to him.
It educated me to the other side, just gave me an understanding of what my dad life was like growing up. You know what I mean? As much as I am a black person from America, I'm a black person from Africa too. I embraced both sides of that after I went out there. You know what I mean?
Felmon, there in the Netherlands, is that something you relate to, this idea of carrying multiple identities?
Yeah, definitely, you know, because the thing is, we are born in here in Holland, but our parents teach us the roots of our country. For me, I'm more Eritrean than Dutch. And the reason why is because I'm a black guy. So for me, it's more easy to see myself in the mirror as an African than as an European. But I'm also Dutch because I'm born here.
Felmon Hagos is Eritrean Dutch and organizer of a vigil for the late rapper Nipsey Hussle last night in Rotterdam. Thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you for your calling.
Want a slice, got to roll the dice, that's why all my life I've been grinding all my life.
Vigils around the world are being held for Nipsey Hussle. Go to theworld.org for a look at how the Eritrean community in St. Paul, Minnesota is mourning him. I'm Marco Werman. A singer-songwriter from Cuba channels her family's past.
I learned it from my mom, and my mom learned it from her grandmother. It's an old music, but it's also new music for people like me.
Singer Emma Alfonso takes Afro-Cuban musical traditions into the digital age. That's ahead here on The World. Just last week, it seemed as if Saudi Arabia's government was starting to respond to international pressure over human rights. It released several women's rights activists from prison. But then came more arrests. We're hearing about 8 people who've been detained now, and 2 of them are Saudi Americans. The World's Shirin Jafari reports.
One of the Saudi Americans arrested is Saleh Al-Haider. He's the son of a prominent women's rights activist who was released from prison just last week. Basma Momani is a Saudi analyst who teaches at the University of Waterloo in Canada. She says she was shocked when she heard the news.
Because one had expected that there was a climbing down, that the regime or the government was trying to, you know, move the spotlight away from the continued arrest of the Saudi activists. We had seen the release of at least two of the activists, and slowly, slowly they were being brought forward to the courts.
The woman who was released last week, Aziza Al-Yusuf, has fought for years for women's right to drive. Last May, as the driving ban was lifted, she was arrested and imprisoned along with about a dozen other activists. But last week was a joyful moment. The first thing her son did was to take a selfie with his mom and post it online. It shows them in a tight embrace. Both have huge grins on their faces. Today, though, the son and mother have switched places. It's now Haider, the son, who's in prison, and his mother is on the outside.
There's a new chill now, I think, that's going to be evoked with this new arrest of all of these family members of activists.
Haider is a U.S. citizen. He owns a home in Virginia, but lived with his wife and children in the kingdom. Among those arrested this week are writers and intellectuals, a husband and his pregnant wife. It's surprising, Basma Momani says, that they are considered a threat, given that they all had either stopped their activism or were never politically active in the first place. There's no official explanation for their arrests. But Momani says it seems their only crime is being related to activists.
For them to be arrested is really quite cruel, and it does, I think, make it very clear to a lot of individuals that there is collective punishment. It is not just about your particular life that is going to be upended. It may be your family's. And I think that's really chilling.
Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman has gone after activists, dissidents and academics since he came to power in 2015. These arrests have created a sense of fear among Saudis, says Momani. Saudi Arabia has been under pressure from the international community after the murder of the Washington Post columnist Jamal Khashoggi. Maryam Lowy, professor of Middle East politics at the College of New Jersey, says the latest arrests show the Crown Prince is not bowing to pressure from the outside.
The Saudi government is saying that the reactions of the international community, the various governments and organizations and associations, does not affect them, and they will continue to run their internal affairs as they see fit.
This week, the Senate Foreign Relations Committee confirmed John Abizaid as the U.S. ambassador to Saudi Arabia. It's the first time the U.S. has an ambassador to Saudi Arabia in 2 years. For the world, I'm Shirin Jafari.
25 years ago, over the course of 100 days, some 800,000 people were systematically killed in Rwanda. At the time of the Rwandan genocide, Gadi Hambumugisha and Musa Uwitonzi were young boys. Their families were killed. Gadi and Musa ended up in an orphanage. It was difficult. But things changed after an American photographer came to the orphanage and gave them disposable cameras. As kids, they went around documenting the social aftermath of the genocide they survived. Today, Gadi and Musa are both professional photographers in Rwanda. Their story will be part of a forthcoming documentary, Camera Kids, from our partners here at WGBH's Ground Truth Project. Gadi and Musa, now grown men, talk to me about that formative experience with their first cameras. Here's Gadi.
Living in the orphanage, we were not able to interact with our community. But since we got the cameras, we were invited into people's homes. We didn't know that children have their own bedrooms in their families, because for us, we lived in the dormitories. So we discovered new life, different life that these people around us were living in.
So both of you, Gadi and Musa, I mean, in the orphanage, it sounded like a kind of secluded environment, almost sealed off from people in Rwanda. What did photography allow you to say, Musa?
I mean, we were strangers to this community. And when photography came, then it kind of bridged the gap between us and the community. And then we got to become friends, and we went to visit them, and they could come and visit us. So I find photography being the bridge between us and the community.
In the documentary Camera Kids, you both confront the past. What do either of you remember of the genocide?
I was 2 years old.
This is Gadi.
Hard to remember exactly the situation. The memory of the genocide or the impact of the genocide was with me from the time I was brought back by the Red Cross from Democratic Republic of Congo, where we had fled, being brought back to an orphanage in Rwanda. But also when I was on boarding school, every weekend you would see your classmates with their mothers and fathers, and you kind of feel lonely. But of course, we understand that it's impossible for caretaker to like visit every boarding school where every Imbabazi orphanage kids was going to school. But that's how actually we confront the genocide, what the genocide had done to me.
Part of the documentary, Camera Kids, takes the audience back to the 94 genocide, and you meet perpetrators of the genocide, many of whom serve prison time, and you photographers confront these perpetrators and their families about the genocide.
The example you gave, calling them cockroaches and snakes, they were your neighbors. You knew that they were good people. You knew that they were not snakes. What were you told in class and in government teachings that made you change and believe that was true?
Musa, what was it like to be meeting the people who, it's pointed out, could have likely killed your parents?
I would say it was really scary. I mean, we are photographers. We want to have that story. But then in that particular moment, I was brought back to the genocide. I mean, remembering all those things that have happened.
Gadi, how did you have room in your heart to have a sit-down conversation about something so horrible?
I thought I would get an answer to why. But of course, I did not get an answer because whatever they were saying is not satisfying. I mean, as Musa said, it's not easy because at some point you just imagine that why wouldn't these people be someone who killed my parents? We don't know them, but they accept that they killed people and many people, even people they don't know. The fact that they reconciled with the survivors, to me, is an answer.
Musa, do you think your immersion in photography allowed you or helped you in some way to face these perpetrators?
Absolutely. I mean, like, these perpetrators made me an orphan. Photography really helped me face this because I'm part of the change. I should really face these people. And I faced it to have a better understanding of what really happened and why it happened. As Gadi mentioned, there's no valid answer from them, and they're not the ones to say we did this for this particular reason because it is not valid. But seeing families visiting each other again, that heals our hearts, and we are now we feel like something has improved and something have happened. People are reconciling again, and people are becoming human again.
Musa Yuitonze and Gadi Habimodisha, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you very much for having us.
Thank you so much for having us.
Musa and Gadi are photographers in Rwanda. Their experience surviving the Rwandan genocide 25 years ago will be told in an upcoming documentary, Camera Kids. It's produced by Beth Murphy here at WGBH's Ground Truth Project. Brazil's far-right president, Jair Bolsonaro, has been called Trump of the tropics. But a few weeks back, he made comments about immigrants while he was in Washington that angered even part of his own base, Bolsonaro supporters here in the U.S. In fact, some Brazilians are demanding answers this weekend when Brazil's vice president visits Boston. Giovanna Romano Sanchez has a story.
When Jair Bolsonaro met with Donald Trump in the White House last month, it was kind of a love fest.
He has done a very outstanding job, ran one of the incredible campaigns. Somebody said it a little bit reminded people of our campaign, which I'm honored by.
Bolsonaro returned the favor, saying he was a big admirer of Trump. But it was comments that Bolsonaro made in a Fox News interview that upset his supporters in the U.S. He said he backs Trump's plan for a border wall. And then he said this through an interpreter.
The vast majority of potential immigrants do not have good intentions or do not intend to do the best or do good to the U.S. people.
Bolsonaro later apologized that he meant to say that a little part of the people who immigrate don't have good intentions. But for Brazilians in the U.S., the comment was hard to take. Framingham, Massachusetts, has one of the highest concentrations of Brazilian immigrants living in the U.S., and nearly 90% of them supported Bolsonaro in the election last fall.
I am one of the voters who voted for Bolsonaro.
Fernando Castro came to the U.S. 32 years ago and worked his way from dishwasher to business owner. Like most of the Brazilians I spoke with here, Castro doesn't like Trump.
I'm not Trump supporter because an immigrant, because his policies, I think, is not impacting this country positively.
So when Bolsonaro made that negative comment about immigrants, Castro was frustrated. He thinks Bolsonaro is trying to imitate Trump, and he shouldn't, especially on this issue.
What he says is pure ignorance because he doesn't know what the life of an immigrant lives in this country. Although I still think he can fix this, and we might vote for him again.
Right across from Castro's business, I met JB, a young Brazilian who just immigrated to the U.S. JB asked me not to use his name because he fears it could affect his status here. JB did not vote for Bolsonaro. In fact, he says he left to get away from the new government.
It's the hate speech he promotes. He himself would not come after me, but his extremist supporters would feel entitled to, backed by a leader who supports it. I'm gay, I'm black, I'm poor. It would affect me from many angles.
JB says people in Framingham have been trying to justify Bolsonaro's anti-immigrant comments.
He convinced people that everything that is said about him is fake news, so it must be fake news.
Natalicia Tracy is among the small group of Brazilians here who didn't support Bolsonaro. She is the executive director of the Brazilian Worker Center, a labor rights group. She says that even with Bolsonaro's apology, people were still upset by his comments.
People who were defending him before are starting to quiet down. Like in space, there would be heated conversation about him. It's now quiet.
And some of them, she says, are demanding a response. This weekend, Brazil's Vice President Hamilton Mourão is visiting Boston, and a group of Brazilians have requested a meeting with him.
The goal is for him to explain how it was a misunderstanding, what the president said.
A spokesman for the vice president says they still don't have a final confirmation for a meeting. For The World, Giovanna Romano Sanchez, Boston.
Okay, this is going to sound a little science fiction-y, but stick with me here. Imagine you are an asteroid, blissfully speeding through the quiet of space, when all of a sudden, a spaceship comes out of nowhere and fires on you, blasting a hole on your surface. Okay, the sound effects are fiction, but the story is not. Today, a Japanese spaceship called Hayabusa 2 did actually fire on an asteroid as it traveled some 180 million miles from Earth.
The Japanese really have made history today with this mission. It's what exploration is all about.
That's Deborah Domang with the Planetary Science Institute in Arizona. She's a scientist on the Hayabusa 2 mission. Today, the Japanese spacecraft fired a small copper ball the size of an orange at the asteroid, and the resulting explosion created a crater. The goal firing on the asteroid, says Domang, is to explore what lies beneath the flying rock surface.
Asteroids themselves are sort of the remnant pieces of the early solar system, and understanding what they're made of and how they're put together is important in understanding the evolution of our solar system and how planets are made. But these objects have been around for a while, and their surfaces have been exposed to the space environment. And that alters the chemistry and the structure of the material on the surface. So to understand the original composition, the unprocessed composition, you need to get underneath. You need to get below the top layer so that you can get an idea of what the pristine materials are like. And that was the purpose of making the crater. Can we see what's just below the surface?
The Japanese Space Agency also deployed a space camera to watch today's explosion on the asteroid. Deborah Domingue says the Hayabusa 2 spacecraft has already sent some pictures back to Earth. More photos and scientific measurements will be coming soon, but she says it'll be several weeks before scientists really know what they've uncovered on the surface of the asteroid. Dan Robbins died this week. His name may not ring a bell, but his life work is known to child artists and adults looking to zen out. Robbins was the guy who brought us paint by numbers. Imagine the detailed black outline of a famous picture with a numbered guide that shows you where to put a few brushstrokes of cobalt or cerulean. The world's Sarah Birnbaum went to a craft store to see his legacy in full color.
Hi. Do you know where the paint by numbers kits are?
Paint by numbers kits are going to be... You go straight down that way?
My coworker Indra Ekmanis and I went to the Blick paint store in Boston, and I gotta say, the selection was disappointing.
So we have some rhinoceros. I think this is a picture of the Kremlin or of a Russian Orthodox church.
It's onion. Moscow. It's Red Square with like...
the onion dome is very iconic. Yeah. Then for some more nature scenes, we have a wolf and some dolphins. A lot of animals to paint.
Yeah, clearly animals is like a big thing. Which one should we buy?
It was a no-brainer, really. Okay, let's we're the world, so we had to go with St. Basil's Cathedral in Moscow.
658 is your total.
If this were 1955, I'd have way more options. Former Smithsonian curator Larry Bird says paint-by-number paintings were everywhere back then.
At one point, more number paintings were hanging in Americans' homes than original works of art.
My favorite story is that when you walked into the West Wing in the Eisenhower White House, you'd see a gallery of paint-by-number paintings by administration officials.
President Eisenhower had a chief of staff, Thomas Stevens, who buys a bunch of paint-by-number kits, and he passes them out at the next cabinet meeting. And the cabinet officers assume the president is asking them to paint them. Okay.
Even though there's some disagreement about who actually invented the paint-by-numbers concept, the man who started the craze was Dan Robbins. In the 1940s, he was working on washable paints for kids for the Palmer Paint Company in Detroit. And as Dan recalled during this interview in 2013, his boss called him into his office and said,
"Can you come up with an idea for adult, for grown-up paint sets?"
Dan was stumped until he remembered something he learned in high school, that Leonardo da Vinci had the system where he'd get these big commissions, and of course he'd be too busy to do the work all by himself because he's Leonardo da Vinci. So he'd separate the panels into numbered sections and have his apprentices fill them in.
I said, "That's it. That's it."
Paint-by-number kits didn't take off immediately, but by 1955, the company was selling 20 million kits a year. And eventually, the kits became synonymous with the cultural conformity gripping America. But curator Larry Bird says that misses the point.
The legacy of Dan is that he helped democratize access to the apparatus of art by putting brushes into people's hands.
And that's a lovely legacy to have. For the world, I'm Sarah Birnbaum.
So much for any preconceived notions about painting by numbers. Hey, art is a growing living thing. Here's Exhibit B. That's the legendary Cuban band Síntesis, founded in the 1970s and huge to this day. Many of us Americans have never heard of them, but Emmy Alfonso can tell you all about them.
They mixed this Afro-Cuban music that were like Haydn back in the 80s with rock and jazz that were forbidden, and it was an explosive fusion at that time. And I love the music that my mom and my dad do, and of course it's present now in what I do and in all my stuff, my lyrics, my melodies, everything.
Emmy Alfonso's parents, as you heard there, were the founding members of Síntesis. Now Emmy is moving their Afro-Cuban fusion with rock and jazz into the future. It's clear on Emmy Alfonso's new album, Voy. I do hear a lot of the influence of your parents' band Síntesis in your music. This ear that you have on the past and You're very open to kind of any contemporary way of bringing the past into the present and the future. Is that intentional or just the way you make music? Is that kind of the way your parents operated and you can't help yourself?
Yeah, well, that's what I learned. I don't force to do anything in my music. I just compose. And I think everything that I have inside, in my mind, all my influences are there. I just let my music go on, and that's the result. You know, this new music and this mix of Afro-Cuban legend with jazz and soul.
Yeah, you keep mentioning the Afro-Cuban tradition, and there is, I hear in your music, a deep respect for old traditions like Yoruba, West African tradition, Santeria, which is, you know, centuries old. So, like a song Rezo, can you help us understand why this song sounds so new and fresh?
Well, this is a prayer from back in the 40s. This were recorded in some place in Matanzas. I learned it from my mom, and my mom learned it from her grandmother. So it's something that is still alive, and it's an old music, but it's also new music for people like me in the new generation that doesn't know this kind of music. So it's a beautiful thing. We have the tradition alive of Afro-Cuban music, and that's what I'm trying to do in my stuff, in my music.
So when a song like Rezo comes on in Havana, and you've got some young people around, will they start like dancing to this?
Of course. They knew the rhythms. Yes, they knew the rhythms, and they knew some of the words. This is like a traditional Yoruba. It doesn't exist anymore. So you know some words because maybe in some religious parties. So the new people, the young people, they know that something is going on there. They don't exactly know what I'm telling them, but they feel familiar with the music.
Musician Emmy Alfonso speaking with us from Havana. Her new album is called Boy. It is a real treat, and if you want some more Emmy Alfonso, as well as other artists we've had on the show recently, check out our Spotify playlist at PRI The World. And speaking of Boy, me voy, nos vamos, we're out of here. The World's theme music was composed by Eric Goldberg. From the Nan and Bill Harris Studios at WGBH in Boston, I'm Marco Werman. Have a great weekend.
PRI, Public Radio International.